My guests this hour are an amazing collaborative team representing three major arts organizations in West Michigan. They are the Kalamazoo Junior Symphony's Andrew Kohler, as well as the Kalamazoo Children's Chorus's Darlene Tsang, and we have the artistic director of the Kalamazoo Bach Festival here as well. And we're all talking about the exact same event. This is a major coming together of forces to perform Carmina Burana by Carl Orff. Welcome. Good morning, everyone.
Good morning. Thanks for having us, Kara.
I'll start with you, Andrew. The concert will be held on Sunday, a week from Sunday at 4 p.m. in Chenery Auditorium. That is the home of the Kalamazoo Junior Symphony Orchestra. This will serve as the final concert of the KJSO season.
Exactly right, yep.
And it's going to be such a memorable occasion for all the musicians involved and hopefully the audience.
That's the aim, of course. Yeah, no, we're really excited. I mean, especially when you put together a collaborative work like this, the excitement just keeps building all the way to the end, you know, because the orchestra, of course, rehearses separately, as does the chorus. And then when you finally start getting the bits and pieces to come together, and then little by little, you know, we had one rehearsal now with the Bach Festival chorus, the main chorus. And then our next rehearsal, we have two left. We're going to add the children's chorus. And then in the final rehearsal, we'll add our soloists and we'll really have all the pieces in place. And so it'll just be a headlong rush to the concert.
Fortunately, as we discussed before the microphones were turned on, all of you have been involved in productions of Carmina Burana in the past. Chris, you said you've actually performed or directed four performances.
This will be the fourth, yeah. It's kind of the war horse of the repertoire. It's the only piece that choral music can claim as being sexy, so we try to do it as often as we can.
Oh, I'm sure that's not true.
I guess there might be a few exceptions, but the most popular one. Yeah, yeah, to
you're
be sure.
Singing in Latin, but it's a somewhat lusty lyrics at times.
Quite racy.
Yes.
Yes.
And Darlene, you've also brought the children's chorus, and in this case, the treble choir, to local performances a couple of times. The children's chorus, I should also mention, we hope to touch on a spring concert that's coming up, and that's this weekend, right?
No, actually, our spring concert was last Sunday.
I missed it. I'm so sorry. But some auditions are happening.
Auditions for next year's season are happening, yes, the last Saturday of April and the first Saturday of May. So okay. We are looking forward to bringing in some new voices into the chorus then.
Well, I'd like to open this up for a general discussion on Carmina Burana. There's a lot of stories that go with this piece. You've already brought up the interesting lyrics to it. The history of it is fascinating. Carl Orff, who was he?
Well, so it's very interesting. You know, every year at Kalamazoo College, where Chris and I both teach, we have a senior seminar in music where we usually do a deep dive into one work. And we often choose the work that the chorus and the orchestra happen to be collaborating on. So this year we decided to go with Carmina Burana. So Chris and I are relative experts at this point on all things context about Carmina Burana. So in answer to your question, who was Carl Orff? He's something of a man of mystery. He was always fiercely guarding his private life and his independence. And anytime people were interested in sort of biographical details of his life, he sort of pushed back and said, no, let's just talk about the music instead. He really very much wanted to be seen as someone who was a pure musician operating outside of the realm of politics. And there's a very easy reason why that might be the case, and that is because Carmina Burana and Carl Orff's great success came at the height of National Socialism in Germany. That is, the Nazi Party was in power. Now, the interesting thing is there's really nothing, I mean, people have debated this endlessly. In my personal opinion, there is absolutely nothing about this music that sounds in any way fascistic, even though some people hear that in this music, or rather attribute it to it because of the context in which it was birthed. But really, in the end, this music is a clear outgrowth of Carl Orff's natural musical tendencies. And those natural musical tendencies are a fascination with late Renaissance masters like Monteverdi and like Orlando di Lasso, and also a fascination with the newest experiments that Stravinsky was involved in. So that particular sound of Stravinsky, say, about a decade earlier in the 20s, if you think of Les Noces, or even if you think of The Rite of Spring, something like that, those ballet scores in which there's this hard-driven, steely edge to the timbres, right? Because there's a lot of, I mean, Les Noces itself doesn't even use an orchestra. It's just four pianos on stage and a percussion section. And that kind of biting, driving sound is definitely one of the things that informs Orff's music making. The other thing that informs Orff's music making is, of course, his long history of pedagogical work. That was one of the ways that he first started really establishing himself in Germany. As such, he had this sort of vision for a really simple, elemental kind of music educational system where kids would have the opportunity to learn basic forms and simple melodies and use those to build more complex things out of them, but also give them lots of room for experimentation and for self-discovery. And in a lot of ways, I think one of the reasons why Carmina Burana was such a hit for audiences and was something that meant so much to Orff was because it combined all those things at once. I mean, it had those elemental forms, it had those melodies, but of course raised to the level of sophistication that it could be on a concert stage instead of just, performed by, say, a beginning five-year-old hammering something out on a xylophone. But yet there's a relationship there to that. To that fundamental concept of music. It also was a sort of updated version of Wagner's Gesamtkunstwerk aesthetic, in a way, that is to say the total artwork. He envisioned this piece as something that, he envisioned all music, indeed, as combining movement and word and, to some modest degree, narrative. You know, all those things, sort of all the arts collaborating into one, to truly move the human spirit, in much in the manner of, say, a Greek tragedy.
When Carmina premiered, was it seen as something truly successful, or were people saying, that sounds a bit like Stravinsky, or what was the reaction?
That's a brilliant question. So that is also a point of controversy in Orff's history, because after the Nazis were defeated and Americans occupied Germany, or at least the part of Germany, Munich, where Orff was based, he somewhat misrepresented that. He said that the Nazis never liked this music, that he never got a favorable review, and that he really suffered because his music was unliked by the Nazi authorities. That, unfortunately, was not entirely true. In fact, the Nazi authorities did come around to liking his music. They were quite suspicious of it at first because it was new music, because it was not in a overtly romantic vein, which is kind of what their preference was, you know, really sort of conservative, more old-fashioned at that time sounding music. And not least because it was in a mix of old German, old French, and Latin, none of which seemed sufficiently German enough to them. But the thing was, the music was so good that the audiences took to it so immediately that despite a few negative reviews and some other positive ones, audiences loved it so much that they realized it was a runaway train and that they couldn't stop. So they just got on board and decided. The amazing thing is, you know, we think of perhaps an image like Stalin and his control of music in the Soviet Union. That was much more granular than what happened in the Third Reich, believe it or not. For all the, you know, shocking, unbelievable abuses of humanity that happened in that place, music was one of the things that was not very tightly controlled. Mostly the issues came down to Jewishness, unfortunately. It was a racial sort of prejudice. If you were a Jewish composer, then that was problematic. But the style of music wasn't really the issue. It was for some people, and some people tried to make that happen, but there was significant disagreement within the ranks of the Nazi Party. And so music like Orff's, which was not exactly the ideal, at least for some members of the Nazi Party, eventually became accepted. And that was really the start of Orff's sort of worldwide fame.
Kind of have to wonder whether or not they maybe thought of it as a one of those propaganda things that they could have, you know, shown a different face.
Oh, they absolutely
of what was happening,
did.
You know, in Germany.
If it was a Soviet composer, Stalin would have loved it.
Yes, right. No, I know. Well, right. Germans too. They were very eager to have. Well, I mean, you think about the 1936 Olympics, right? I mean, Germany was very self-conscious about its image on the world stage, and certainly took that idea very seriously. So yes, I think that's absolutely the case. Once they saw the popularity of this work, they thought, well, this is something that we might be able to use to our ends, which is always the extraordinary danger of fascism, right? I mean, and why there are some contemporary commentators who would say that they hear that in this or other music of that era.
I wonder if we should continue with at least a short addressing that the piece now belongs to the world. And I mean, it, from those origins, Carmina Burana is feels like a celebration of life to pretty much any arts organization that performs it.
It is most definitely that. And indeed, you know, the origins of this music or the origins of the text stretch back far before that. Of course, Carmina Burana means the songs of Boyan, of Benedikt Boyan, this location where an old manuscript was found, you know, beautiful illuminated text with illustrations from the 11th century, written by wandering scholars. Who were presumably training for the priesthood, but who nevertheless were also just regular guys who had, you know, interest in beautiful women and drinking and gambling and all these other sorts of things that humans engage in, and wrote some songs about that within a larger context about fatalism, about how fate is unknowable and how the wheel of fate turns. So the very first illustration in that collection from the 11th century has sort of four stations that say, I will reign, I am reigning, I have reigned, and I am without a kingdom. And that is the overriding principle that sort of unites all these ideas. There are then songs about spring, there are songs about love, and there are songs about drinking and gambling. But in each case, they turn on the idea that fortunes are ever-changing for us as human beings. And so that is a fundamentally universal experience. And indeed, I would argue that Karl Orff, despite all this controversy that I think is very interesting to discuss, was someone who was very much trying to channel that universality, both in the way that he employed the original text in its original format. Even, frankly, he writes directions to the performers, and he always writes it in Italian. He never writes it in German, but he always writes it in Italian because, I think, of his interest in those old Renaissance masters and his sort of homage to them in a very subtle way.
This is a collaboration between the Kalamazoo Junior Symphony, the Kalamazoo Bach Festival Chorus, and the Kalamazoo Children's Chorus. There are also three professional soloists coming in to sing some of the very difficult solo parts of Carmina Burana. Tickets are available through, I'm assuming, both the Kalamazoo Bach Festival and the Kalamazoo Junior Symphony. The websites are easy to find, kalamazoobachfestival.org, kjso.org. And the concert is a week from Sunday, not Easter Sunday, but the week after, in Chenery Auditorium at 4 p.m. Chris, maybe you could tell us about the soloists you've hired
to sing.
And they're we should also mention that they're giving another performance outside of Carmina mm-hmm. Burana.
The soloists for this, we had a change up. Haley Clark was a soprano, was supposed to be doing that role and then ended up getting a job that she just couldn't turn down. And so we've quickly replaced her through the magic of the internet and colleagues that made good recommendations with a woman named Jennifer Forney, who is most known for doing Cho-Cho-San in Madame Butterfly. She's performed at the Met all over the world and came highly recommended and is just delightful. She lives in Missouri now. But I think she'll be fantastic in the role. And then Terry Barber, who I think has done things here before. He's a countertenor, so he'll be no surprise to audiences that have seen him around here before. And then Elliot Madore will make his presumably Kalamazoo debut with us as the baritone. And there's a lovely, you know, the subtext, I think, in this. Of course, Terry plays this roasting swan on a spit you know, in the role, which is really bizarre. But then there's also the subtext of the relationship kind of developing between the soprano and the baritone as they go through this piece, leading to her big climax at the end before the wheel of fortune begins turning yet again. And so we hope to represent some of that subtext. I think getting to what you were talking about with the Gesamtkunstwerk and this whole large work of art idea that is so all-encompassing. Now, we have logistical challenges at Chenery in the stage size and the orchestra size and chorus size.
I mean, meaning, just the percussion battery is...
Right. It's quite a lot of real estate up back there. But, you know, we're going to try to build some of that relationship still between the soprano and the baritone, just in the way that they enter. So they will not be, you know, sitting on stage, but actually trying to portray this sort of, this creating some heat between them, shall we say. And then, of course, as you mentioned, they are performing in a recital at Kalamazoo College on Friday night.
2 days before this performance. Yeah. So that information, again, at KalamazooBachFestival.org. Well, I don't know where else to begin but the beginning of this, of Coming to Birana. This is the most familiar section and has been appropriated hundreds of times in film and television. So.
Even dance clubs.
Dance
I went
clubs?
To a club in Chicago once. My wife, she was not my wife then, but we were there dancing, and all of a sudden, it was a hip hop remix of the O Fortuna that you're presumably going to play right now.
It's so popular.
That was our cue to leave.
Well, you'll hear it in its original version, performed by hundreds of musicians on a week from Sunday. Do you have that actual date?
April 28th.
28th.
4 p.m.
The 28th at 4 p.m. Here's a musical break, and we'll be back with Andrew Kohler, Darlene Tsang, and Chris Ludva. Well, we can't continue playing the full recording, of course. It takes about 50 minutes or so, but that's the opening to Carmina Burana, and it gives you just a tidbit of the power of that piece. The full performance is Sunday, April 28th at 4 p.m. at Chenery Auditorium with the combined forces of the Kalamazoo Children's Chorus, and specifically the Treble Choir, and the Kalamazoo Junior Symphony Orchestra, and the Kalamazoo Bach Festival Chorus. I threw out the number hundreds of performers. I'm safe there, right?
We definitely have over 100 people on stage, for sure.
Three soloists as well that are have busy careers internationally and are coming to Kalamazoo to sing the roles in Carmina Burana. And there's also an opportunity to hear them in recital 2 days before on the Friday, the 26th. I believe that will be at Kalamazoo College.
Yep.
And you get to meet the soloist in a really intimate way in a recital. The Kalamazoo Bach Festival will have already kicked off and is continuing a lot of events. Just so you know, listeners, I'll be talking to the executive director on Monday so that we can cover a lot of what's going on over the next couple weeks with the Kalamazoo Bach Festival. But back to Carmina Burana. And fatalism. I'm kind of fascinated. Like, was this a common way of thinking in the medieval times? And what really is fatalism? It sounds like it's like it's sort of a depressing mindset, but it's not necessarily that.
I mean, this is definitely outside of my realm of expertise. So if others have greater insights, please chime in. But my sense, yes, my sense is that the very strong sort of cultural hold that Catholicism had on the European continent at that time would have led a lot of people to see life as a kind of brief but endured misery that was but a prelude to something better. But that, yes, that life is something that is largely out of your control, right? I mean, you think about concepts like, royalty, right? Just having somebody who happens, divine right kings and things like that, right? One of the things I guess that's interesting is that despite that, there is a bit of a sarcastic edge to these poems. Hmm. And, you know, for example, there's a line that sort of says, power and poverty, one never really knows what one's going to get, or one will soon switch to the other. And then, but then says, but that king, you know, the king who is highest of all is most poised for a fall, or something like that, you know? Mm-hmm. So there is, I think, just a burgeoning sense. I mean, you consider, for example, how in that era, we don't know the names of the people who wrote these poems, right? In other words, psychologically, they didn't think to themselves, it's even important for me to recognize myself as an individual writing these poems. I was just doing this for whatever this, I mean, in some cases it would be for the greater glory of God. I think in this particular case, these have such a bawdy edge to them that I don't know that they would have seen them, and particularly in that context, but it would not have been expected that anyone would think it even worthwhile or important to say, I blank, would insert name here, actually wrote this poem. That was a concept that, resting in the individual, trying to get rights, trying to live life as fully as possible while you had it, was something that was a little bit later on and wasn't really necessarily tied to this period. So I think that's one way through which we can see the lens of some of the fatalistic texts here. But like I say, there's also this very modern, very sarcastic edge. And fundamentally, again, when you look at stories of love, stories of fate and gambling and drinking, these are all activities human beings still do enjoy partaking in.
I think there's a lot of joy in the course of the piece, too. I mean, you can hear it's not as if it's only the wheel of fate, you know, just grumbles along at the ground level. But there is always this, you're up, then you're down. And then I think by depicting this, you know, kind of this flowering of springtime. And I mean, we were rehearsing the other night and just it happened to be a really beautiful day that day. And people had been out and about, and you could really sense that sort of energy, especially on the college campus, you know, of flowering and of, you know, coming into one's own. So you hear that really present in a lot of this music and the way that he set it with these dances. You know, there's a really heavy waltz influence and as well as some multimeter things like that. And I think it's pretty obvious that you feel that sense of joy and anticipation, which then, of course, is snuffed out at the end by the turning of the wheel, but not before hearing this wonderful climax or having this heat, this energy build between the two soloists and having the chorus almost as the Greek chorus, sort of not just bystanding and watching what's happening, but commenting on it, sometimes involved in it. It's as if they're egging it on as it goes. And then, of course, we have the kids, which add this sort of beautiful kind of purity and cherubic quality. I don't know. Do you want to talk about that, Darlene?
Yeah.
How cherubic your kids are?
Well, yeah, Darlene, of all the performers on stage a week from Sunday, the young singers will be the newest to the material and will have been maybe sharing some of their opinions with you or their friends about learning this piece. What are some of the challenges and some of the maybe more lighthearted moments in putting this together with the treble choir?
The biggest challenge is just that they're singing in a foreign language. So that's
a big one.
Yeah, that is big, and it's wonderful to expose the children to that. But once they got into that. They've just loved singing it. Our part is not very big. It's quite small in the piece, but they've had such a good time learning the music and it and the style of it, and I think their eyes are going to be very widely open when they hear the chorus and the soloist come in, because they've just been, you know, working on their part. So I think that's going to be eye-opening for them.
Did you start rehearsing this even before you presented the spring concert last week?
Yes. Yes, we've been working on it since January. I mean, yeah. Along with our other music that we were preparing for our concert. So,
which is when you lost four rehearsals, yeah. You said earlier, to snow days, right?
Right, exactly. Well, lost a month's worth of rehearsal this winter due to snow days. But we've been working on it for quite a while, but they are really enjoying it.
Have they found YouTube performances that they enjoy?
I had given them a recording of it that they could listen to and work with at home also, so they would have extra practice with it. So they have. I don't know if they've listened to more of it than that, you know, on their own or not, but.
There's one that they would probably be advised not to go see, the Pennell. There's some great things to watch out there on YouTube on Carmina.
Of all the pieces in the repertoire, this one has more groupies than just about any other big piece. Like, people will travel to see Carmina Burana. I can't help but wonder if many of those groupies just had one performing experience, you know, in high school or college, and it's from then on, it's sort of like, oh, Carmina, gotta get back there and see it.
Well, it's so, you know, it's so beautifully written in terms of it's in some ways very repetitive. Mm-hmm. So a lot of the things divide into threes, and so you have the same tune three times in a various section. So I think, you know, the language is probably the most difficult thing to get in the piece, at least for the choirs. But I really love the fact that it's sort of, you know, so often in the choral world, at least, we're either in a secular mode or we're in a sacred mode. And the two don't usually meet in some ways. But I think this, having been written within this you know, abbey, by these monks who clearly had these other urges and feelings that they were having that they wanted to write about, or at least were observing those behaviors in the people around them. And so it kind of skates in between the two worlds of the sacred and the secular, and paganism. And I mean, it's just, I think maybe that's for me, the universality of it, is that it kind of defies categories in that way.
Well, we need to jump back into the music so that, Chris Ludva, you can get back to school and be on time for your next class. Would you tell us what we might be listening to next? I think we see something.
Floret Silva. Yeah, so this is the flowering of the woods, and this is very much one of those celebratory, joyous return of springtime and all of the blooming and whatnot that comes with that, be it metaphorical or literal.
Thank you.
That may sound unresolved, but it will be resolved on Sunday, April 28th in Chenery Auditorium, when the Kalamazoo Children's Chorus, the Kalamazoo Bach Festival Chorus, and the Kalamazoo Junior Symphony present Carmina Burana. Conductor Andrew Kohler is here, along with the director of the treble choir, Darlene Tsang, and Chris had to leave for his professional duties back at school at Kalamazoo College. So we can continue our talk about, you know, philosophical details and with this, but let's talk a little about some of the forces coming together. We just heard what sounded like a female-centric chorus singing in a section called In the Field, did you say? Was
Yeah, it's part of a larger section called In the Field, which is a part of the Spring is Blooming.
Primovere.
Mm-hmm, yeah. Exactly.
The third section, or that second section to come along, is In Taberna, which you mentioned are drinking songs.
Exactly, in the tavern, yeah.
I'm drinking and gambling. Those will have more male chorus sounds.
You're very right about that, yes. Good instincts, Cara.
When you take the score, Carmina Burana, you know, you've known it's on your calendar for a year or more, and do you start on page one?
That's an interesting question. Well, in this particular case, this is already a work that I've done before, so I already have a sense of it. But I always like to start with the largest possible picture and then work in. So if this is a piece that I've already known for a long time and therefore is already kind of in my ear, I don't necessarily need to listen to it. If it's something very new, then I will often try and listen to it just so I get a sort of a broad sense of it. But yeah, I try and look at the full picture of the score as much as possible from start to end, get a sense of the various component parts. In a work like this, the component parts are very easy to spot. Because they're broken up into, I mean, you know, there are 25 separate shorter songs in this piece. And then within them, as Chris mentioned, one of the sort of elemental music qualities that Orff was going for was just to have very simple folk-like strophic repeats. That is to say, if there are three stanzas in a poem, then that same music will repeat three times until that all the words have run out. As such, it's quite simple, I think, to see the form. So whereas, say, in a Brahms symphony, that would be quite a bit of labor to sort of uncover the details of how the big form fits together, here it's quite on the surface. And that's one of the things that I think gives this piece such electrifying immediacy for audiences, because it's just immediately graspable, and because the tunes are so good and feel as if you've known them your whole life already. You hear them once and you think, I've been singing this since I was a child somehow. But yeah, and then one works in successively greater and greater detail, you know, just kind of makes his way to individual melodic ideas, individual harmonies, details that Orff or any composer would put in the score. Sometimes he's got very lengthy descriptions, you know, like the baritone should sing this with great gesticulation and a mocking character throughout, or something like that, but all in Italian, you know, which, I mean, my Italian is pretty basic, so I can get my, like, maybe three quarters of that, but then I have to look up the rest to make sure I understand exactly what it is that he's going for.
But you don't have a baritone, and you haven't had a baritone to work with.
That's right.
You have instrumentalists who are rehearsing without the song alongside.
Correct.
The piece.
Well, you know, in this particular case, with the Junior Symphony, I have the luxury of a little bit more time than one would if you were working with a professional group. You know, we have more rehearsals. And so at the very first rehearsal, I brought along a page of the translations of the text. And before we read each movement, I read out at least the first stanza so people would have just a sense of what it was that they were playing. Because I wanted them to have, at least in broad strokes, you know, some relationship to the meaning of the music. So that's, you know, also an important part of this. I mean, anytime one works with text, one has to take that into account. That's such a critical part of understanding the music.
Distilling it to everyone, so have the feel. Darlene, I was going to ask you about Carl Orff because he, again, has something to do with children's development. He had theories and practices that are still used today in education, music education, but I think it goes beyond that. Are you very familiar with, what is it called, the Orff method or the Orff?
Schulwerk, he called it. Yeah, just the, which is just schoolwork. Yeah, German for schoolwork.
Have you come across that, Darlene?
Yes, we used that in the, when I was teaching elementary school, I used it a lot in the music classes that I taught. And the whole series of Orff instruments that we have that are used with that technique, and it brings together instrumental and vocal work, which is what, you know, we're doing here in a very larger form. But yeah, in a very fundamental form, it would connect those areas of music together for small children and allow them to have a performance that combined those as well.
It's integrated. So
yes,
they're
very
singing,
much so.
Playing.
Right.
Are they moving
and
at
movement
all?
Also. And there, yeah, there
so
are
dance.
Three parts to it. So a third of the class does the movement, a third of the class sings, a third of the class plays the instruments, and so you have a performance of all that integrated together.
Now, there are only so many musically inclined young people in any given community. Do you ever fight over who joins what group, the junior symphony or the children's chorus, or can you do both?
You can do both. I actually remember a student from a few years ago who was in both of our ensembles. Occasional conflicts, but we worked it out.
We have children right now in the touring choir that are playing in the orchestra for this performance. So it was we do share children. Sometimes it's difficult because of the time commitments, but we have so many talented children in Kalamazoo. It's absolutely amazing, but it's great to be able to work together this way with the children in the community. I think it allows them to see the various different areas of music, not just their own single, you know, instrumental or vocal, but they're being involved in all of that together.
For the auditions that are being held at Millwood United Methodist Church this weekend?
Next weekend, the 27th
of
April.
It's Easter.
Saturday the, yes. Saturday the 27th, and then the following Saturday, May 4th.
How young and how, what's the age range that can audition?
You need to be entering third grade next year. All the way through 12th grade are eligible to audition. So we have choirs that fit the different ability levels, and the auditions are very short in nature. The younger children we audition in groups rather than individually because that's kind of scary for many young children to have to stand up and sing and by themselves in front of people they don't know.
I'm glad you mentioned that because just the word audition kind of gives me that little shiver.
Right, right.
You just picture.
So we do it in a small group of about 10 children at a time, and we just play some music games and sing some rounds and do some fun things together so that I can walk around and get a sense of voice and where they're at with that. So
for parents who are listening, what is the time commitment if you are a member of the children's chorus?
We rehearse one night a week, Tuesday nights at Millwood United Methodist Church. And other than that, it's basically the one night a week commitment. And then we have two major concerts during the year, one in December and one in April. And a couple of Saturday rehearsals before those concerts. And then, of course, we have other events like this one that we're participating in, Carmina Burana, and that go on during the year. So different choirs are working with different groups in the community to do other performances as well.
And then every 5 years or so, a tour?
Yes, this summer the touring choir is traveling to Costa Rica for 13 days. So we're looking forward to that.
That sounds wonderful.
Yes, that will be quite an adventure.
And I can ask Andrew the same question, time commitment, auditions.
Oh, well, we do have auditions coming up for the Junior Symphony. That'll be, I think, June 9th. There's information about it on our website for those who are interested. For the, you know, we have many different levels. We have a preparatory wind orchestra now, and we also have several tiers of string orchestras. For the Junior Symphony itself, that's when those auditions are happening in early June. And the time commitment is quite similar to the one that Darlene was just describing. Our rehearsals are usually on Sunday afternoons, with occasional dress rehearsals, you know, added extra rehearsals before concerts on Thursday nights, usually Thursday nights. And then we do about, we generally do three performances a year. And of course, the additional time commitment is, you know, practice and being good at your instrument and
knowing your part.
Yes.
And additionally, Andrew, now's the time. We are at near the end of the hour to forward promote the Arcato Ensemble, which is another collaboration with the Bachfest.
Yes. Yeah, that's going to be the concert that ends this season. So Carmina Burana kicks it off, and then we end with a performance of a small professional chamber orchestra that I always am so grateful to get a chance to work with, and the Bach Festival has been gracious enough to help me make it happen. And so the Arcato Ensemble, my chamber orchestra, which involves many familiar professionals to your listeners from the Kalamazoo Symphony, as well as faculty from the School of Music at Western, will gather together. We'll do some beautiful music of Vaughan Williams, five variants on Dives and Lazarus, which is an incredibly beautiful piece. The Adagietto from Mahler, Symphony No. 5. And a really wonderful, quite new work by a contemporary composer named Chris Theophanidis called Visions and Miracles. And it's that piece that gives the entire concert its title. And then on the second half, Chris will lead that same Arcato group with a sort of subset of the Bach Festival, a sort of core singers of the Bach Festival. And they'll do the Vivaldi Gloria as well as a work on their own by Gielo. So each piece on the concert has something to do with either a religious revelation, in the case of the Vivaldi Gloria, but also just a more generalized sense that there are wonderful, miraculous things that happen in our world and seemingly something beyond it.
Not so fatalism, not so much fatalism.
That's right. We begin with a dark wheel of fate and end. No, I mean, Carmina, as Chris rightly pointed out, really, you know, part of that wheel of fate is joy, right? I mean, at least two of those stations are anticipation of reigning and then being really on top. And I think part of the message of Carmina Burana is enjoy that while it happens. So that's part of what we'll be doing on stage.
Well, let's finish with music from Carmina Burana. We haven't had much chance to listen to extended sections of it, but I'll just have to leave it in listeners' imaginations and, of course, their fate of being in the seat, being in their audience seat on the 28th, Sunday, 4 o'clock, Chenery Auditorium, Carmina Burana, bringing together three soloists, the Kalamazoo Children's Chorus's Treble Choir, the Kalamazoo Bach Festival Chorus, and the Kalamazoo Junior Symphony. What shall we end with here?
Well, I think why don't we show a slightly quieter side to things and do number 21, In Trutina, which is In the Balance. This is the soprano talking about being pulled between earthly and also spiritual desires, but it is one of the most surpassingly lovely moments of the entire work.
Darlene Tsang and Andrew Kohler, thank you for joining me on WMUK.
Thanks so much for having us.